Flashman and the Angel of the Lord by George MacDonald Fraser. Continued. Cassette 9, side 2.
I didn't mind lying there holding my private little Thanksgiving service and listening to the distant murmur of the mob outside. And after a while, Marines came at the double, placing lanterns on the engines, shrouding the broken windows and loopholes, heaving the wrecked door into place and closing it behind the little officer. And a tall civilian in a tile hat and frock, missivy, surveying the ruin impassively, prodding at Joe's corpse with his walking stick, and then picking his way carefully through the bloody straw to where I lay. He looked down at me, stroking his moustache with a gloved finger, the long-jawed Yankee Corinthian as ever was, and just the sight of him looking so cool and civilized cheered me up even further. "Well, well," says he, "how are you?" I couldn't be bothered to think of a smart answer, so I said, "Pretty fair." He asked if I was wounded, and when I told him, he sighed, removed his hat and gloves, looked for a place to put them, declined the corporal's offer to hold them, and finally set them down on the engine. Then he stooped to examine my neck and knee. "Nothing that soap and water won't cure," says he. "Mr. Green, would you be good enough to bring them yourself with bandages, a towel, some spirits, and a marine cloak and cap?" He rose, smoothing his coat, and resumed his hat and gloves. "Now, I want a marine guard round this building. No one to be allowed closer than 20 yards. That," he indicated Joe's body, "is to be removed after dark and buried away from the town, and the burial party are then to forget all about it. This gentleman," he turned to me, "never existed. You'll not mention him, and if questions are asked by anyone, you never heard of him. Is that clear?" Green nodded, looking keen. "Corporal, you understand?"
"What gentleman are you referring to, sir?"
asks the leatherneck, staring to his front. Messervy gave a faint smile. "I beg your pardon, I should have said sergeant, shouldn't I, Mr. Green?"
"Yes, sir," beams Green. "I'll see to it."
"Capital. Now, I'll be leaving here presently with someone in a marine coat and cap. We are to be ignored, and I trust by that time you will have dispersed any gaping sightseers. The soap and water now, if you please."
They were all I needed to complete my restoration, and when Green had brought them and left us alone, I sluiced away the filth with a will. I felt as though I was cleansing myself of Harper's Ferry and John Brown and the whole disgusting business. The wounds looked clean enough, and when I'd clapped on the dressings, Messervy helped me with the bandages, talking to the point as usual. Brown is not only alive, but surprisingly well, and damn talkative, which, as you know, is the last thing we wanted. The old brute must be made of leather, run through the kidneys, the doctor tells me, and has lost any amount of blood, though you'd not know it to hear him, conversing like a politician, which I suspect he is. He knotted my neck bandage and stepped back. "Pity you didn't shoot him. It would have saved a few lives today, and who knows how many hereafter."
"Well, mine wouldn't have been one of them," says I. "Not with Joe crowding me in that doorway."
"Ah, yes, Joe." He glanced at the body. "Your work, I take it. The Marines had orders not to shoot. Settling a score, were you?"
"Accident. He got in the way when I was sighting on Brown."
Why shouldn't I get credit by pretending I'd tried to do a mess of his dirty work for him?
"Since you were so all-fired eager to have Brown dead, why didn't you get the Marines to do it when they stormed this place? Or have someone shoot him yesterday? Hang it, he was walking around town large as life. Why don't you slip something in his dinner now? And don't tell me it ain't your style."
"Unofficial death warrants have a habit of recoiling," says he coolly. "My countrymen have one great failing. They talk too much."
"Aye, so you shanghai some poor bloody foreigner to do the job. Well, I didn't have the ghost of a chance until today. And I'll tell you, Massivy, I ain't apologizing. I served your turn because that damn little squirt Seward put a pistol to my head. But why the hell should I murder for you? Tell me that."
He shrugged, leaning against the engine and stirring the straw with his cane. "Oh, it would have been convenient. Now, the law must take its course, and God only knows where that will lead. Still, that's not your affair. I guess you did what you could to keep Brown out of Virginia."
"You're damn right. A pity your own people didn't do as much. I still can't fathom it. You knew what he intended, where he was, who his backers were, what men and money he had. Confound it, you knew the very bloody place. Here. Why in God's name didn't you stop him?" "You and I tried," says he, "but we ain't politicians. What did you call us? Government ruffians?" He wrinkled his fine nose and became businesslike. "Well, that's neither here nor there. The sooner you're out of this, the better. Hurrah for that! Lord Lyons, he don't want to see you. Yes, there's been a word in his ear from the very highest quarter. And warm in your praise it has been, too, but he agrees with us that there's no useful purpose to be served by prolonging your presence in this country a moment longer than need be. Sensible chap, when do I leave? You catch the Baltimore train tonight from the station over the way. The train you're probably familiar with," says he dryly, "since your friend Brown held it up two nights ago. It is now running normally. At Baltimore, there's a berth already reserved for you on a packet sailing for Liverpool tomorrow. It's paid for, and this," he handed me an envelope, "is $300 to cover expenses en route. For which I'd like a signed receipt in the name of Comer, I suggest."
"I'll say this for the Americans, they waste no time. Why, by tomorrow night I'd be at sea with all this horror behind me. A couple of weeks and I'd be in England, home with Elspeth and my Indian honours thick upon me and warm praise conveyed by diplomatic channels. It was too good to be true. And standing there in that beastly blood-stained shed with the reek of powder smoke and the stench of death, I felt the tears start to my eyes and absolutely had to turn away. Massively brought me back to earth. I've arranged quarters here where you can wait unobserved until the train comes in tonight. Go straight aboard, keep to your cabin until you reach Baltimore, then take a cab directly to the dock and the ship. All your tickets and directions are in the envelope with the money. In the meantime, you can shave off your beard, and I'll furnish you with some decent clothes. Keep your collar up and your hat down. No sense in taking risks." That's a word that always makes me raise an eyebrow. "What risk?" I asked, and received one of his ironic looks. "Well, now, I don't suppose you'd want to run into anyone from the Underground Railroad or the Ku Klux on the street, would you? Not that you haven't served their turn admirably. John Brown has run his raid, which is what they both wanted, and while Crixus will go into deep mourning when he learns the result, I'd say Atropos will be drinking your health with 3x3. Still, better not to renew their acquaintance, don't you think?" At the mention of their names, I'd started like the deer gazelle. I hadn't given them a thought since the raid began, but now I'll telegraph to have someone keep an eye open in Baltimore. Anyway, he reassured me, those Ku Klux operators are still in the tombs, by the way, and if Atropos set other men to watch you, what of it? He shrugged. He certainly has no reason to wish you harm after this splendid debacle. He doesn't know about that. He pointed his cane at Joe's body. And he never will. No. Right now, he'll be congratulating himself on $5,000 well spent. He can keep it for me, says I, and meant it. You're right, though. Why, he'll think I've done him proud. Which you have, says he dryly. Prouder than you did Crixus or the U.S. government. Not that your efforts aren't appreciated. He was peering through a crack in the makeshift door. I think we might venture out now. The citizens seem to have lost interest in the sight of Marines guarding a dilapidated firehouse, though I dare say the souvenir seekers will be stripping it bare shortly. What? You don't care to take a brick as a memento? There were still a number of folk idling beyond the armory gates, staring hopefully through the railings. But our way led into the armory proper, where Mesovid commandeered an office guarded by two beefy civilians in hard hats. One of them brought me an enormous fry from the wager house, with a jug of coffee, and I smiled to think what the little waiter would have said if he'd known who the customer was. From that I turned inevitably to fond memories of the generous Mrs. Popplewell. Gad, she'd been an unexpected windfall. Splendidly equipped, if you like abundance, which I must say I do after a long abstinence. Resourceful lass, too, finding me a bolt hole. And loyal, the way she'd answered back those ruffians who'd been threatening her. Aye, she'd served her turn in more ways than one. Bless her black bounties. There was a cot in the office, but I was too excited to sleep, so I followed Mess of his advice and removed my face furniture. All but the moustache and whiskers, of course.
It's a great delight to see your chin again after a hard slog in the field. Reminds you that there are finer things in life, like England and home, and sleeping sound, and strolling down Piccadilly with your hat on 3 hairs, and women, and drink,
and Elspeth.
I was grinning at myself in the mirror when Messavy bowled in and told me to put on my cap and coat double quick and to muffle up well. He had something to show me. I followed him, wondering, along an alley between the armory buildings. He stopped at a door and told me to pull my cap well down over my brows.
"Stay close behind me," says he softly, and led the way.
There was an open inner door ahead with men's backs turned to us. Messavy went right up behind them, and I followed, peering over his shoulder. The little room was crowded with people, standing and sitting, all intent on a man lying propped up on a pallet against the far wall. And I bit back a gasp. It was J.B. He'd never been a happy sight, but now he looked like the proceeds of a grave robbery. They'd washed the blood out of his hair and beard and given him a clean shirt. But his face was gaunt and pallid, tight over the bones, and there were dark stains under the sunken eyes. But they were burning still with that same grim fire, and his voice was harsh and strong as ever. For he was croaking away on the old line about how he'd come to free the slaves, and for no other purpose. No one had sent him here but God and J.B., or the devil, if that was how they chose to view it. And he could have got clear away, but had been concerned for his hostages, and the fears of their wives and daughters in tears, if you please, and had wanted to reassure anyone who thought he was only there to burn and kill. Someone cried out that he had killed people going quietly about the streets. J.B. replied that he didn't know about that, and had done his best to save lives. He'd been fired on repeatedly without shooting back. "That's not so," cried another. "Why, you killed an unarmed man by the tracks. Yes, and another one." J.B. turned his head with an effort and pointed a talon at the speaker. "See here, my friend. It's useless to contradict your own people who are my prisoners. They will tell you otherwise." There was a babble of protests and questions, and I saw that two fellows sitting close to him had pencils and notebooks. Newspaper reporters, if you'll credit it. The rest of them were sober citizens. Lee was there, and a dignified cove who I believe was the governor, and Jeb Stewart with a face like thunder, and all crying out and badgering away at the old beggar, and him with a hole clear through to his kidneys and his head cut to bits. My first thought was, "Why, you bloody vandals, I don't shock easy, and have no more of the milk of human kindness than you'd put in a cup of tea. I'll taunt and gloat over a fallen foe any day, and put a boot in his ribs if he sasses back. But I'm a brute and a bully. These were your upstanding pillars of society, bursting with Christian piety and love thy neighbour. And here they were, shaking their sanctimonious heads as they harassed and goaded a seemingly dying man. Aye, and feasted their eyes on him as though he were a beast in a circus, when you'd have thought the decency, on which I'm an authority, as you know, demanded that he be let alone. They even had the effrontery to argue and hector him now that he was beaten helpless. I'd have liked to see him argue with him 8 hours back when he was standing up with his guns on. Why, flashy, you ask? This ain't pity or sentiment, surely. Not a bit of it. Don't mistake disgust and contempt for the tormentor with compassion for the victim. I didn't pity J.B. one jot. But I was enraged at first sight by those worthy ghouls enjoying the sensation. Say, don't talk to me about John Brown. Why, I sat as close to him as I am to you this minute. Spoke to him, too, and told him, yes, sir. And as I watched him, old and stricken and frail, answering so calm and courteous, well, I couldn't help thinking, good for you, J.B., that's your sort. And then it dawned on me that the old bugger was fairly reveling in it. He got his audience at last, hadn't he just? The first of that worldwide congregation who would revere his name and sing his song and enshrine him in history forever. I'll swear he knew it. Lee had asked him if he'd like the mob excluded, but J.B. wouldn't hear of it. Come one, come all, was his style, so that he could preach to as many as possible. That there were enemies who'd come to vent their abomination of him and his notions, or to gloat, or just to indulge their curiosity, made it all the better for him. He could answer their harrying and abuse with urbanity and resolution. And that's where the legend was born, believe me, in that shabby little paymaster's office. For in whatever spirit they came, they left in something like awe and admiration. "The gamest man I ever saw," the governor said. And Jeb Stuart, who was bloody rude to him at the time, I may say, remarked to me years later that without men like J.B., there wouldn't be an America. You see, like so many legends, it was true he deserved their respect. And didn't he know how to make the most of it, the vain old show-off? Here were his enemies, the ungodly oppressors of the enslaved, against whom he'd struggled for years, who'd cursed him for a border cutthroat and nothing more. And now they were hanging on his words, recognizing him in dead earnest, with wonder and no little fear. Ironic, ain't it? He'd failed and found his triumph. Wounded and doomed, he was a man uplifted, and he laid it off to them with his matchless mixture of deep sincerity and sheer damned humbug. You can read all 3 hours of it in the New York papers of the time, and it's an education. I heard only some of the words, but they should be enough to give you the tune, which was truly extraordinary. There he was, wounded in half a dozen places, too weak to stand, fagged out and facing certain death, and talking as easily and pleasantly as though he were in a drawing room, answering their questions like a kindly old professor dealing with backward students. When a young militia greenhorn scoffed that he couldn't have hoped to achieve anything with just a handful of men, J.B. looked him over, smiled, and said patiently, "Well, perhaps your ideas and mine on military matters would differ materially." And when another demanded that he justify his acts, he sighed as though explaining something to a dunce for the umpteenth time. "I don't wish to be offensive, but I think, my friend, that you of the South are guilty of a great wrong against God and humanity. I believe it is perfectly right for anyone to, interfere with you so far as to free those you wickedly and willfully hold in bondage. Please understand, I don't say this insultingly." He went on to lecture them on the golden rule of doing unto others as they would have others do unto them, which for some reason put Jeb Stuart in a bait, for he accused J.B. of not believing in the Bible and got a pained look and a gentle, "Certainly I do," in reproof. Jeb, the ass, came back at him. When someone asked how much he'd paid his followers and J.B. said, "No wages whatever," Jeb cried out piously, "The wages of sin is death," to which J.B. replied gently, "I would not have made such a remark to you if you had been a prisoner and wounded in my hands." He rubbed salt in it by observing that he could have killed Jeb just as easy as a mosquito. They tried to make him tell who his northern backers were and got nowhere. "Any questions that I can honorably answer, I will," says he. And when they quoted a letter in the papers from a prominent Yankee abolitionist predicting a slave uprising, he even raised a laugh by saying dryly that he hadn't had the opportunity of reading the New York Herald for the past day or two. More soberly, he went on, "I wish to say that all you people of the South should prepare yourself for a settlement of the slave question. And the sooner you are prepared, the better. You may dispose of me very easily. I am almost disposed of now. But the question is still to be settled." Once or twice, I regret to say, he lied. He claimed that he'd been wounded, after I had consented to surrender for the benefit of others, not for my own. He didn't surrender, ever, not that I heard. He also claimed that he had not impressed any slave against his will. And to my astonishment, someone called out, "I know of one Negro who wanted to go back." And who should it be but Aaron Stevens, lying on a pallet farther along the wall? I had to crane my neck to see him, mighty pale, with a bloody bandage on his chest. Who that Negro was, I don't know, But J.B.'s biggest stretcher was that he'd done his damnedest not to kill anyone. I dare say he meant it, but you've read my account and can judge for yourselves. When someone called him a fanatic, he bristled up and said they were the fanatics, not he. At which the governor weighed into him, telling him his silver head was red with crime and he'd do well to start thinking of eternity. J.B. put him down in his best style. "Governor," says he cheerfully, "judging by appearances, I have about 15 or 20 years' start on you in the journey to that eternity of which you so kindly warned me. 15 years or 15 hours, I'm ready to go. The difference between your tenure of life and mine is only a trifle, and I tell you to be prepared. All you who hold slaves have more need to be prepared than I." "It's going to be worse than I feared," says Massavi when we were back in my quarters. "Far worse. If only he didn't sound so almighty reasonable and saintly, damn it." He was more upset than I'd seen him. Absolutely tweaked his moustache instead of stroking it. "What did you think of him? From an English point of view, I mean." "What I was thinking was that I was damn glad I'd shot Joe when I did. I'm as sentimental as the next man, you see." "From an English point of view? Well, they'd not take him in whites. Not sure about the reform, though." "Oh, very well, seriously, then. They mayn't put him up in Trafalgar Square in place of Nelson. But it'll be a close-run thing, if you hang him, that is. Put him in a madhouse and nobody'll notice." "He's not mad," says Massavi. "I'm not sure he wasn't the sanest man in that room. No, he'll hang, before the next election, fortunately, or he'd be liable to beat Seward for the Republican nomination. Join me in a drink. My sorrows are in need of submersion." He poured them out. "I ask myself, if he talks like that when he's shot full of holes, what will he be like when he's better and standing up in court with every paper in the country reporting him?" "We'll be lucky," says he thoughtfully, "if this doesn't lead to war. Well, we must just hope for the best." I thought he was talking through his hat. One crazy farmer being topped for murder and treason didn't strike me as a reasonable casus belli, which shows how much I knew. But it didn't matter to me anyway, so I devoted myself to the brandy and contemplation of home while he sat meditating. Finally, he gave a little rueful smile and said reflectively, "Do you know, Flashman, sometimes I wish I had presidential power and the whole U.S. Treasury to draw on secretly." I said I'd fancy it rather above half myself. And what had he in mind? "At this moment, I'll tell you, I'd consider very seriously paying you and Pinkerton a fortune to rescue John Brown from the clutches of the law and spirit him to Canada. 'Twould be an international scandal, I dare say, and a great rattling of sabres, but I've no doubt Buchanan and Palmerston could settle it without too much fuss, possibly with the assistance of Prince Albert and our northern liberals. Interesting idea, don't you think? Highly diverting. What good would that do? Apart from sparing us a martyr, it would unite North and South as nothing else could. Perfidious Albion meddling in our most sacred private quarrel. Even the die-hard abolitionists would be up in arms against you. You could have him shot trying to escape," says cynical Flashy. "Too late now," says he and closed his eyes. "If only he could have stopped a bullet in that engine house. If only that ass Green had been carrying a saber instead of his toy sword. What we might have been spared. Well, we can only leave it to the lawyers and politicians and the great American public now. We've come to the parting of the trails, JB's and mine, and high time too, if you ask me. He was to take the high road to the gallows and immortal fame, and I the low road to... Well, I'll come to that in a moment. First, I should tell you briefly and at second hand what happened to him in the little time that was left to him, and the momentous effect it had on America, and I dare say on the world. My last memory of him is in that paymaster's office, propped up on his mattress, battered but bright-eyed, not 2 pounds of his stringy old carcass hanging straight, but laying down the law in his best accustomed style, God help him. And I suppose I must say God bless him, too, for form's sake. Of all the men of wrath who have disturbed my checkered course, he's about the only one towards whom I feel no ill will. Old pest and all that he was. He was decent enough to me, and if he led me through hell and high water, well, you might as well blame the lightning or the whirlwind. I wasn't there to see his departure from the ferry next day, but he came near to being lynched. There was a great crowd full of drink and fury when they put him on the train to Charlestown. He and Stevens had to be carried through the throng, baying for their blood in panic as well as rage, for the wildest rumours were flying that the raid had been only the prelude to a general invasion, that the slaves were on the brink of rebellion, that a great conspiracy was brewing in the north. It was even reported that a family in a village just a few miles from the ferry had been massacred. But when Lee went galloping to the scene, he found everyone safe in bed and the slaves tranquil. The fact was that not a single slave had joined in the raid, other than those taken by Stevens from Washington's farm and places nearby, and most of them had slipped off home as soon as they could, or been passive altogether. But the mischief was done. A great thrill of fear ran through the South. Virginia was preparing for war. Some places were under martial law. Dixie suspected, quite mistakenly, that it was sitting on a black powder keg ready to explode, and the storm that broke in the newspapers only added to the hysteria. One of Lee's first acts had been to send Jeb Stuart to the Kennedy farm, where they found all J.B.'s papers and correspondence, with the names of his northern supporters, which the brilliant old conspirator had left behind in a carpet bag. And once the Democrats and pro-slavery journals got hold of the names, the fat was in the fire. The Black Republicans, the Secret Six, and even moderate abolitionists became the villains of the day, plotting to wreak havoc in the South. And among those who came in for special vilification, and serve him right, was William H. Seward, the cigar-chewing blighter who'd blackmailed me into the business in New York. He was the arch-agitator who was responsible for this insurrection. And for all I know, this may have cost him the presidency. It did no good for him and other Northerners, including Lincoln, to condemn the raid. All the South could hear was the growing peal of admiration for Brown, the champion of liberty, which came even from those who deplored what Brown, the raider, had done. You can see the South's point of view. He was a murderous old brigand who was out to overthrow them. And you can see the North's. He was a fearless crusader who wanted only to set black men free. Both views were true, and one can't blame the Southerners for believing that he represented the North in its true colours, or the North for believing, as one speaker put it, that whether his acts had been right or wrong, J.B. himself was right. The truth was that he'd fueled the passions of the wildest elements on both sides and convinced even sensible and moderate people that the only answer was disunion or war. His trial, which began only a week after the raid, fulfilled most of his glummest fears. Here was the poor old hero, so weak and wounded that he had to be toted into court on a cot, submitting to his fate with Christian patience. In fact, he wasn't as poorly as he looked and could walk when he had to. And he put on the performance of his life, telling them he'd never asked for quarter, and if they wanted his blood, they could have it there and then, without the mockery of a trial. As to his defence, he was utterly unable to attend to it. My memory don't serve me. My health is insufficient, although improving. I am ready for my fate. I'll bet there wasn't a dry eye from Cape Cod to Cincinnati. The trial was a formality, or a farce, if you like. Much was made of the speed with which it took place, but if they'd given him until 1870, it would have made no difference. But there could be no question of his guilt, or the penalty. His lawyers would have had him plead insanity. Half his ancestors were balmy, you know. But the old fox wouldn't hear of it. And you know, if I'd been called to testify on the point, I'd have had to back him up. I know that in these pages I frequently called him mad and lunatic, and suggested his rightful place was in a padded cell. But that's just flashy talking. We all say such things without meaning that the object of our censure is seriously deranged. No, he wasn't mad. Read his letters, his speeches, the things he said to reporters, and take the word of one who knew him well. A fanatic, yes. A man driven by one burning idea, certainly. A fool in some things, perhaps, but never a madman. It wasn't a long trial, but seems to have had some interesting features. One of the prosecutors was too drunk to plead, they say, and t'other was the father of one of the men who'd murdered Bill Thompson on the bridge, which I'd have thought made for a nice conflict of interest, but I'm no lawyer. None of that, or the legal wrangling about jurisdiction and delays, was of the least importance. Only one thing mattered, and that was the bearing of the accused. That's what the world remembers. The brave old border soldier. Calm, dignified and unflinching. Rising gamely to speak with a chap supporting him either side. Lying patiently on his cot as sentence of death was passed. Closing his eyes in unconcern and pulling the blankets up beneath his chin. Even the most hard-bitten pro-slavers couldn't but admire the conscientiousness, the honour and the supreme bravery of the man. You may imagine what the good ladies of Concord and Boston thought, and the fervour with which they wept and prayed for him. They made the mistake of giving him a month's grace before he was topped, which meant that all America could picture the gallant, lonely old martyr in his cell, worn with struggle, but wonderfully cheerful, waiting with quiet courage for the end. It gave the wiser heads time for second thoughts. Some suggested that he should be jailed or put in an asylum. But they knew the revulsion with which his execution would be greeted, not only in America, but the world. They knew that his martyrdom would only harden the resolve of the North to carry on his campaign, and the determination of the South to resist. On the other hand, there were those who hoped that his death would hasten the rupture between North and South, which they regarded as inevitable. Mess of his notion of a rescue occurred to others, by the way. There was a plot, but when J.B. heard of it, he wanted no part of it. He wanted to die, I'm sure of that, because like the wiser heads, he could see clearly what it would lead to. The last note he wrote on the morning of his execution put it plain. I, John Brown, I am now quite certain that the crimes of this guilty land will never be purged away, but with blood. I had, as I now think, vainly flattered myself that without very much bloodshed, it might be done. They hanged him outside Charlestown, Virginia, on December the 2nd, before a great host of troops, among whom were John Wilkes Booth, who murdered Lincoln 6 years later, and Stonewall Jackson. He didn't kiss a little black child on his way to the gallows, as the sentimentalists like to believe, but as he rode on his coffin across the meadow, he looked around and said, "This is a beautiful country. I never had the pleasure of seeing it before." When they asked if he wanted to signal before they dropped him, he said it didn't matter, but he didn't want to be kept waiting. His admirers, of course, treasure such details, but what struck me peculiar when I read about it and made me think, yes, that's my old J.B., was that he was hanged in his carpet slippers. They rang the bells for him in the North, and there was talk of statues and memorials and such an outpouring of eulogy and grief and noble sentiment as would have done credit to Joan of Arc and Lord Nelson together. I doubt if any man in the history of the United States was more deeply or sincerely mourned, and I ain't forgetting friend Abraham either. He was even more detested in Dixie than J.B., and he was just a politician, while J.B. was a fighting man and a rebel, a combination which no American can resist. Even in the South, they respected him for his courage. I remember the verdict delivered to me during the Civil War, of a grizzled Alabama veteran, crimson with booze, and chewing on his Wheeling Toby. A particularly pungent cigar, that was. "Oh, Lassa, what, Tommy? Well, now, sir, I reckon he lived like a skunk,
and died like a lion.
I'm not arguing. You know my views on bravery, and by now you should know I'm on JB. He was a bit of a crook, and a lot of a humbug. And he put me through the mangle, and there's a case to be made for saying he was the most evil influence ever let loose in North America. 750,000 is a powerful lot of dead men, to say nothing of wounded and crippled and bereaved. You may say their great war would have happened anyway, but he's bound to bear some of the blame. Maybe you would have thought it a price worth paying for the destruction of slavery. But I say slavery would have ended anyway, without the war, and without him. But that's no business of mine. I came through Harper's Ferry and the war that followed, so he did me no lasting damage, though he scared the innards out of me and took a year out of my life. I can tolerate him at my time of life, and when I hear the grandlings singing the old song, I can look back, if not with pride, at least with a curious satisfaction, as the young faces pass by in memory. Kagi, Stevens, Oliver, Watson, Lehman, Cook, Taylor, Ed Coppock, the Thompsons, dear old dangerous newbie, and all the other ghosts, white and black, whose features have faded. And last of all, the grizzled old Ironside with his eagle face and burning eyes. No doubt my satisfaction is because I'm still here and they're all long gone one way or another. Watson died of his wounds. Coppock and Green, who'd survived the engine house fight, were hanged 2 weeks after J.B., as was Cook, who got himself captured in Maryland, the duffer. Stevens survived the 4 bullets they took out of him, but was hanged in the spring of 60 with Hazlitt, who'd escaped from the ferry but was caught later. The black, who was with him in the arsenal, got clear away, and so did the fellows whom J.B. sent back with the wagon to collect arms. And the man who'd been left behind at the farm, Merriam, who'd brought the $600. And Tid. And another of the young men, and Owen Brown. All those who escaped served in the Civil War. 2 of them died in it. Except Owen, who lived to a ripe old age. Like your humble obedient. As I say, I take no pride in my part in Harper's Ferry and was a damned unwilling actor, but, well, I was one of John Brown's pet lambs, after all, and dine out on it regular, and am redeemed, very slightly, in the eyes of such as Miss Prentice and others of the elect, who figure that an old man, however deplorable, must have some good in him if he stood at Armageddon and battled for the poor downtrodden darkies. They don't know about Joe, of course. Which brings me back at last to the point where the trails parted and I went my separate way from Harper's Ferry, rejoicing, en route to Baltimore and home. I spent the day resting in the office, which Messavier had made my quarters. He was out and prowling about most of the time, like a good little civil servant, and when we dined together in the evening, he told me what he'd seen and heard. I could see he was depressed and agitated, for he frowned at least twice and stroked his moustache both sides. What was disturbing him was that Stuart, as I told you a moment ago, had found all J.B.'s letters at the Kennedy farm, and the wager house was agog with rage and alarm at the proof they appeared to contain of diabolical Yankee designs. "That stupid off wise," this was the Virginia governor, "has been reading them aloud to the drunken rabble over yonder, and you may guess the effect. By this time tomorrow, half the South will have heard of them and be convinced that a Northern army is on the march, with the Republican Party in the van, intent on rousing the slaves to butcher their masters and burn every plantation between here and Texas." "What immutable law," he went on, "decrees that the obtuser the politician, the higher he will rise? I suppose it takes a peculiar combination of the imbecile, the toady, and the braggart to run for office in the first place. Can't Wise see the harm he's doing? Or can he, I wonder?" I looked intelligent, and he explained that Wise was a former secessionist who might be out to make mischief. "He's put them in a rare frenzy, I can tell you. Packs of drunken ruffians are out nigger hunting this minute, and at least 2 fools have been arrested who claim to be John Brown raiders. Harper's Ferry will be lucky if it's still standing in the morning.
I put you on an earlier train, by the way. No sense lingering in this madhouse.
So it was about midnight that I wrapped a scarf round my chin, pulled my hat down, and made the short walk to the station with Messervy at my arm, and the beefy birds striding ahead. As we passed the engine house, shuttered and silent, with the marine sentries on guard, I wondered about Joe, and Messervy must have read my thought, for he remarked, "They buried him down on the river a couple of hours ago." "Lord love me, is that ass wise still at his folly? I believe he won't rest until he has the whole state in an uproar." It was like mafficking night between the armory gates and the station. The wager house was blazing light at every window and shaking to the uproar within. There were groups of staggering merrymakers everywhere, militiamen and roughnecks, some discharging their pieces in the air, others forming raucous glee clubs, and in two places thronging round tub-thumpers on makeshift platforms who were working themselves and their listeners into a riotous frenzy. Their themes seemed to be the necessity of lynching John Brown, closing ranks against the murderous Yankees, and putting every black in the state under lock and key. Or lynching them, too, if they felt like it. Our escort shouldered away through the torchlit confusion of milling figures and flushed, yelling faces to the comparative quiet of the station where the train stood. It had been there half an hour, and Messervy had timed our walk to arrive just as the bell was beginning to clang, and the whistle was adding its plaintive wail to the general din. He didn't shake hands, simply murmured, "Goodbye," with a tap on the arm, and I climbed aboard into the quiet, dim-lit corridor. With only a brief glance at the tall figure raising his cane to his hat brim, in nonchalant salute before he turned away, the darky porters showed me into my cabin, and all of a sudden I was dizzy with tiredness and an overwhelming sense of relief as I sank onto the cot. The train jolted and clanked into motion, and a moment later was booming and rumbling over the trestles of the Potomac Bridge, across which I'd come running, rifle in hand and heart in mouth, only 48 hours before. Now it was behind me, the nightmare which I could hardly believe had ever happened. The rush of action in the dark, the shouted commands, the bearded faces hurrying by, the crack of shots, and the inferno of the engine house. And here I was, safe and sound, bar the two smarting wounds in my neck and knee, rattling over the ties, out of that awful world, and back to life again. I couldn't be bothered to undress. I'd no nightshirt or a blessed stitch except what I was wearing anyway. Have to do something about that. No time to shop in Baltimore, even if I'd been fool enough to venture into the town. Borrow some duds when I got aboard the packet, perhaps. The devil with it. Sufficient unto the day. I was content to lie, exhausted, wondering idly if the porter could forage me a bottle of something sensible. Pat on the thought, there was a soft knock on the door, and his beaming black face appeared.
"Your pardon, sir," says he. "The party in the next cabin axes if you kindly like to partake of some refreshment for you settles to rest."
He chuckled with a knowing look.
"Says, if you sociably inclined, be honored to make your acquaintance over a little glass or two."
I'd seen that look before in French hotels, and while it was unexpected here, it was by no means unwelcome. I wasn't as exhausted as all that. This book is continued on Cassette 10, Side 1.